Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore. Susan Orlean has worked as a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and Vogue, and as a columnist for the Boston Phoenix and Boston Globe. Her articles have been widely published, and she has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1992. She's the author of several books, including Saturday Night, which we're happy to see back in print again, and the beloved Orchid Thief. Susan has always loved animals, so we shouldn't be surprised that her first book of new material since The Orchid Thief is about a dog, perhaps one of the most famous dogs in history. We're delighted that we can welcome Susan Orlean back to the Tattered Cover to present her newest bestseller, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and Legend. Would you please join me in making Susan feel welcome?
Thank you so much. I am so happy to be here. What I'd like to do before I really begin is just share with you this little 5-minute video that I can tell everybody's ears perked up when they heard that music. So let's begin with that and then on with the show. I was working on a magazine piece about animal actors in Hollywood. And if you begin researching animal actors, inevitably Rin Tin Tin's name will come up. His name popped up, and I can still picture the moment where I saw it and had the reaction of, oh my God, Rin Tin Tin. I hadn't thought about Rin Tin Tin in decades. My memory of him was merely that he was a television character in my early childhood. I remember there was this figurine on my grandfather's desk, and we were never allowed to play with it. But I spent so many years of my childhood wondering, why did my grandfather have this Rin Tin Tin figurine? Why was it so important to him? The idea that this character actually spanned countries and lifetimes and generations entranced me, and the story just blossomed. Lee Duncan was a young man in the U.S. Army in World War I. At one point, he was sent to examine a structure that had been hit by artillery. He knew that it was probably a dog kennel. In the very back of the kennel, he came upon a female who had just given birth to a litter of puppies. There was a deep loneliness that he had, and what he found that was inviolable was his connection to his dog. I think everyone has the persistent dream of the perfect friend, the friend who would always be there, the friend who would always be your companion and your protector and your intimate. And I think audiences stepped into that same relationship with the dog. Lee believed that Rin Tin Tin could be the greatest star in Hollywood, and it turned out he was right. Rin Tin Tin became one of the first globally recognized American stars. The feeling of Rin Tin Tin as a heroic dog sort of lifted out of the material world and became conceptual. It was about an idea that a dog could be a hero. And Rin Tin Tin was a hero and was looked upon as a hero by people all over the world. He won the very first Oscar for Best Actor, which was then not awarded to him because the Academy thought it would look strange to give Best Actor to a dog. I think audiences saw him as that ideal friend who'd do anything, save you, and then still cuddle up with you at the end of the day. And that was being proliferated in merchandise, in comic books, on television, in movies. It spread into something really magical and far bigger than just one dog owned by one guy. Writing about a dog, your idea is that it's kind of a lark. It's something fun and funny, and you would never imagine that it would draw you through two world wars, through some life stories that have fairly dark turns. So much of this story is about what we remember and what lasts, especially when most of what comes in and out of our lives doesn't last. Everything that matters to us somehow connects to this very simple idea, which is something mortal or immortal? Is it something that can live on in some way, or is it evanescent? Is it gone?
The National Biscuit Company presents The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin.
Rin Tin Tin was one of those surprising characters that managed to keep living on. It really is about falling in love with an idea and making it last forever. Well, as I said, welcome and thank you. And I think it's so wonderfully fitting that this night, which is, as I said, sort of the last night on this stretch of my book tour, should be here at the Tattered Cover, because it's a place I love. It's an extraordinary store. I'm jealous of all of you for living in a town that has a store like this. It really is a wonderful place, and it's just a real pleasure to be here. So thank you, and thank you for making it this night, which is very emotional for me because it has been a long time out on the road, but also a really wonderful experience. It's the kind of full circle of having been working on this book for close to 8 years, and seeing it out in the world and bringing it on tour as I've been doing since September. It's really been very gratifying, and especially at a moment when there's so much question about, do books still matter? And I can say to you, as far as I can tell, they do. And I'm happy to report from the field that it seems to matter to people to read books. So I'd like to do a bunch of things tonight. I can read you the entire book. What I'd like to do is talk about the book, read some sections from it, take questions, and share with you a little bit about the process of working on the book, because it's such a undertaking, and because it was something that stretched for so much longer than I ever imagined and covered so much more than I expected, it's also been a really interesting experience to be engaged in it for this many years. Somebody said to me the other day, how long were you working on the book? And I said, well, I didn't have children when I started, and now my son can read. So that gives you a vague idea that it's been a long journey. You know, a lot of people have said to me, why did you write a book about a dog? Or why'd you write a book about this dog? Or why? What's the story? And it's very funny because I have an incredibly broad idea of what warrants being written about. I think if you love a story and you want to learn about it, it's worth writing about. In addition to that, to me, this was such a rich, amazing story. It was so much bigger and more interesting than I could have ever imagined. To me, it was as obvious as it could possibly be that it was a story to tell. Now, I didn't expect to be writing it. As a matter of fact, and I've totally forgotten this already, I had a book contract to write something else at the time. But, you know, the glory of procrastination is that, you know, you get a book contract and then you kind of spend some time just living with the glow of knowing you sold a book. But you don't really start working on it, of course. In the meantime, I had been working on a story for The New Yorker about the film and television unit of the American Humane Association. And those are the people who monitor the care of animals on film sets. And they issue the No Animals Were Harmed endorsement on film. And I thought it would be an interesting story to tag along with some of their agents. And it was fascinating. In the course of doing that, I wanted to learn about the history of animals in Hollywood. Well, anytime you look at Hollywood animals, Rin Tin Tin's name will, of course, pop up. So that wasn't so unexpected. What was unexpected was my reaction to it. Now, I probably hadn't thought about Rin Tin Tin in decades, literally, many decades. His name came up. And I sat upright in my chair, and I said, wow, I haven't thought about Rin Tin Tin in 30 years, but it's as if it were yesterday. I immediately remembered how much I had loved Rin Tin Tin when I was a kid, how I dreamed of having a German Shepherd, how I had pestered my parents endlessly for a German Shepherd. And it was just this yearning that I had had from the time I could remember yearning, from the time I could remember wanting anything, I wanted a Rin Tin Tin dog. And I remembered that figurine. So besides having this emotional reaction, I also had this moment of thinking, God, why didn't my grandfather let us play with it? It was just a toy. Well, why was he so possessive of this? This would have been a few minutes of idle nostalgic reverie, except that there is this satanic device that exists in our lives known as Google. And I sat there and I Googled Rin Tin Tin. And what came up immediately was utterly baffling to me. I mean, this was, as far as I knew, a 50s television character, nothing more. And instead, what came up was a Wikipedia listing that said Rin Tin Tin, B, 1918. Born alone was shocking, because to me, this was a character and nothing more. The idea that he was born, but born in 1918? And I kept reading, made 27 silent films. Well, at this point, I said, this is ridiculous. This is crazy. This is baffling. I was saying to my little boy the other day when he said, you know, why was this so amazing to you? And I said, well, what if you found out that Scooby-Doo had been born on a battlefield in 1918, and he was stared at me like, whoa, what are you talking about? He said, well, he was born. I said, all right, never mind. Well, we'll deal with that later. It was the strange, compelling, confusing, baffling idea that a character had lived, and that he had lived in an era that had nothing to do with when I thought he had lived. And it was astonishing. And I decided then and there that I wanted to write a book about it. And it was kind of a plunge off the high board at the swimming pool, because I really had no idea what I was getting into. I didn't even know what it was that I wanted to write or why or what I would find. And I certainly had no idea that I would be spending years learning about everything from the role of animals in World War I to Adolf Hitler's obsession with German shepherds to the birth of obedience training to the transition from silent films to talkies, from black and white television to color. It just felt like it got bigger and bigger. And there were points where I thought Rin Tin Tin really is almost like Zelig. Every time I thought, all right, I've now entered a period of time where Rin Tin Tin simply doesn't exist and has no presence in this period of time, there he'd be. I mean, I knew he was in World War I at that point. I knew he'd been in silent film. And I kind of moved past that period. I thought, well, surely he had nothing to do with World War II. I mean, that's before the television show began. And of course, there he was as the U.S. Army's spokesman for the Dogs for Defense program. So there was no period of time and no form of pop culture that he didn't have a presence in. I was going to say a hand, and then I thought that was not appropriate. So that he had a paw in. In fact, to take this to the extreme of absurdity, I thought, well, one thing we can be sure of is that Rin Tin Tin was never on radio. But he was. He actually had several radio shows beginning in the 20s and then the 30s. And I read the scripts, and I have to say, they were, you know, cops and robbers that were always finally, you know, at the very end, the dog would appear and bark a couple times. But they were billed as Rin Tin Tin Adventures. And I found it rather heartening to know that Rin Tin Tin did much of his own barking, although not all. But what was amazing is that the voiceover artist who filled in the 1920s and 30s in the radio show doing his barking was named, this is one of these trivial pursuit answers, he was named Bob Barker, his real name. It was an incredible, I don't use the word journey casually because I think, unfortunately, it's one of those words that has been utterly devalued and appears on inspirational posters in office cubicles around the world. But it really was a journey. It felt like a journey through time, a journey through my own memories, my own personal story, because I ended up really tracing back to answer that question of why my grandfather was so unusually possessive of this little toy, and more importantly, why would my grandfather, who was already, you know, a fairly old man in the 50s and 60s, why would he have a children's toy? He never watched Rin Tin Tin. And I think I came to be able to answer that question. So I want to begin by, I'd love to read a couple of different sections through the book, and I'm going to begin with a portion from the beginning of the book. One of the things that I did, and that was a sort of kind of persistent theme through my reporting, was, as I said, this strange dichotomy between the life and the legend. The real dog who existed, who was loved by this man, Lee Duncan, who decided to make him a star, and then the legend, the fact that he became a character and became known around the world, literally. It was important to me then to try to nail down the sensation of the real dog as much as possible. So I'm going to read to you from the beginning of the book where I went early on in my reporting to France to see where Rin Tin Tin was born. I mean, that in itself was so strange. You think the ultimate American icon born in France, and even more importantly, was a German war dog, or the puppy of a German war dog born in France. So he became the ultimate American icon, but was neither American and was not, you know, barely a naturalized citizen. It was interesting, though, as somebody said to me, it's, you know, in spite of that, he became so identifiable as American that people almost forgot the fact that German Shepherds were German. So I'd like to, I'll read the section from that particular trip to see where he was born. I went to the Meuse Valley not long ago and spent a week wandering around Toul and Verdun and Fleury to see where Rin Tin Tin was born. I don't usually visit the birthplace of celebrities and stars, and I've never understood why so many people do. I assume it is because they think it might supply some clue about who the person was and who they became. Or maybe the desire is actually more primitive, an urge to absorb something in the air, as if the place itself breathed out the deep essence of the person, the way a volcano vents the deep essence of the earth. Maybe it also provides the idea of a beginning, proof that something large was once a pinpoint of an event. Seeing a beginning allows you to retract time like a measuring tape. That was something I wanted to do with Rin Tin Tin. Before I went to France, I thought it wise to find Fleury, where he was born, on a map, but I could find no such place. I finally decided just to go to the Meuse Valley and try my luck. It was late summer when the light was liquid and everything green was etched with gold. I took a train to Nancy, an elegant old city of figurines and fountains, and then drove to Toul, a few kilometers away, assuming that someone in Toul could direct me from there. It was mid-afternoon, mid-week, mid-month. Toul was as quiet as a soundstage. At last, I came upon a cafe near small town square with a dribbling fountain. A half dozen people were having wine and coffee around a small round table. They had the brash, happy drunkenness of employees who had just been unexpectedly given the afternoon off. All of them were smoking so furiously that it looked as if they were sitting around a small campfire. I sat at a table nearby and ordered coffee. After a minute, I gathered my nerve and my high school French and leaned over to ask if any of them knew how to get to Fleury. They sucked their breath, almost as one, and then frowned at me. "Fleury?" one of them responded. "Yes, Fleury," I said, trying to go lightly on the R, not easy for an Ohioan, but I tried. "Fleury? Fleury?" "Yes, Fleury," I said. I had a copy of Lee's notes with me. I held out the pages and read the part where he had written, "I had been sent to Fleury on the morning of the 15th. At first, they shook their heads. My heart skipped. No one spoke. The fountain dribbled. At last, one of the smokers put a cigarette down and beamed at me. "Oh," he said triumphantly, "you mean Fleury." Another one gasped. "Oh, oui, Fleury." I could discern no difference at all in what they were saying, but they were now congratulating themselves as if they'd cracked an Aztec code. Then they all lit new cigarettes and poured wine and went on with their afternoon recess. The road to Fleury rose and dipped along a ridge, the soft fields falling away in every direction, the huge churches perched here and there, looming and gloomy and dark. Just outside of Toul, I passed a hippie couple walking on the shoulder of the road, carrying a million bags and packs and baskets and boxes. They looked more like a parade float than actual people. A raggedy dog ambled along with them. Hard to tell what he was at first, but when I glanced back at them in my rearview mirror, I could see that the dog had the high forehead and erect ears of a German shepherd. A minute after I passed the hippie couple, I slowed for a leathery old farmer walking with his dog. It was also a German shepherd, glossy and muscular, lashing the farmer's legs with his thick tail as they rode along. I knew that seeing these dogs was merely coincidence, that since I'd begun thinking about Rin Tin Tin, I was seeing him everywhere. And this after so many years of feeling like I never saw German shepherds anymore. It was as if the sheer force of thinking about the dog had made him materialize, as if I'd been seeding the clouds with memories of Rin Tin Tin until it rained. You know, one of the reasons that I think I was sort of attracted to this book, and I haven't really thought about this before, but certainly it occurred to me in the beginning, was the idea of a real person and a Hollywood version of a person was something that I personally had experienced. And Rin Tin Tin, in that way, had that same transformative experience in his life. He was a real dog who lived and breathed and slept at the foot of the bed and had a master, and then he became a figure in Hollywood. And the back and forth between those two images I found really interesting, and a sort of, in its own way, a bit of a pinpoint version of the experience of postmodern life, that things exist both in real life and then the version of it that we experience, sometimes replicated millions of times, sometimes in a film, sometimes in reality television, sometimes online and social media, that we're all now living almost in that bifurcated way of real life and the life as it's received by people around us. So there was something fascinating to me about that part of the story and mediating between those two versions of the dog. Certainly, it was a continuing curiosity to me that what would it have been like for Lee Duncan and then ultimately his daughter to have their pet dog, who they fed kibble at the end of the day, be admired and dreamed about by people literally all over the world. That was one of the extraordinary things about learning of Rin Tin Tin's early life, since the idea that he existed in the 20s and had fame in the 20s that was equal to or possibly even exceeded the fame that he ended up having in the 50s and 60s. That was amazing to me. In the 1920s, my sense of the world was that it was a tiny place and people didn't experience anything other than what they immediately saw. Well, the big surprise to me was that in the 1920s, when film was in its infancy, you know, this was the early, early days of Hollywood, what was incredible to me was that those films were actually distributed all over the world. And I'll give you an example, because even though I found in the Warner Brothers archives their, you know, their tally sheets showing what they were being paid by which countries in royalties for the use of the Rin Tin Tin films, it still was amazing to me until somebody pointed out to me that silent films were actually very easy to distribute all over the world. There was no dialogue. All you had to do was cut out the little intertitled cards, which were minimal, write them in the language of the country where you were, and splice them in. It was really very simple and frankly a lot easier than distributing films that had dialogue. But still, I found it amazing. I mean, in the 1920s, that people were seeing American films all over the world, but they were. In fact, almost no other country, with the exception of Britain, were making the... I mean, the U.S. was making something like 90% of the films being made in the 1920s. So there was a film industry in England, there was a film industry to some degree in France, but nothing like what was going on here in Hollywood. So that we dominated the film industry in a way that... in terms of percentage, we've probably never again dominated it. It really brought home, was brought home to me when I was reading about early Rin Tin Tin films made in the 20s and discovered that the kind of very sad fact that most silent films have been lost. I think more than 50% of them are gone. They were, in some cases, melted. In fact, I read recently that some of them were melted to be used as boot heels. They were cut up and used as stock footage. They were simply not taken care of, and they faded and fell apart. So for a long time, it was believed that only four of Rin Tin Tin's 27 silent films still existed, kind of low percentage. Then in the 70s, somebody was cleaning a movie theater in South Africa, opened a cabinet, and found two Rin Tin Tin films, Clash of the Wolves and Jaws of Steel, that people thought had been lost. And they were sent back with a note saying, you know, probably apologizing for not having sent them back 50 years earlier when they were distributed there. Someone told me recently that, because I always assumed it was a goof that somebody simply forgot to send them back. And someone else said that, you know, these films traveled all over the world, and South Africa might have been one of the very last points on their journey. And someone simply didn't want to pay the postage to get them all the way back to the U.S., so they simply forgot to send them back. Why it was important to me was it suddenly made me realize that this narrow world that I thought had existed in the 1920s, of course, was quite different from what I imagined, that people in the 20s were seeing American films, and it was a clue to the mystery of that figurine. So my grandfather grew up in Hungary, and he didn't leave Hungary until he was in his 20s. And I went back to Warner Brothers and looked at their tally sheet. And, of course, the films had been distributed in Hungary. And it was one of those rare moments when you're working on a book where I took a very deep breath and suddenly realized that there was every reason to assume that my grandfather had seen those films in his childhood, and that his possessiveness of that figurine had nothing to do with the television show. It was his association with it, with his childhood, and in particular, a childhood that really was wiped out during the war and was never there for him to return to. Rin Tin Tin also had a huge part, as I said, in World War II, not only on the American side, where he became the U.S. Army spokesman and was used to inspire people to donate their pet dogs to the Army to use in the war. And he was the inspiration for that. But also on the other side, which was the German army. Adolf Hitler was obsessed with German shepherds. He, as one of his first acts when the Nazi Party came into power, took control of the German Shepherd Club of Germany. And when the man who had developed the breed and controlled the club initially refused to surrender power of over the club to Hitler, he was told that he would be sent to a concentration camp. And he changed his mind very quickly. The Nazis took over control of the breed and saw the German Shepherd as a kind of ultimate Nazi creation. Of course, they were not created by the Nazis, but the fact that they were programmed and developed to be a certain kind of dog and to be smart and strong. And Hitler loved wolves, and he liked the fact that German Shepherds had a wolf-like appearance. One of the things about German Shepherds, and in Rin Tin Tin in particular, I should say, is that people all over the world fell in love with him, and people who had very little in common with each other. And another devoted fan of Rin Tin Tin was Anne Frank, who wrote about him in her diary and wrote about how much she wanted a dog just like Rin Tin Tin. And she would take him to school with her, and maybe the school janitor would watch him while she was in class. Her last birthday, her great wish for her birthday party was to go see a Rin Tin Tin film in a theater with her friends, which of course was impossible. But her parents were able to get a print of Lighthouse by the Sea, which was one of Rin Tin Tin's biggest hits, and showed it to Anne and her friends in their living room. And she wrote in her diary about what a happy birthday it had been to see Rin Tin Tin. That was a moment where I felt that the book was, when people would say to me, what are you doing? And it just, my shorthand was, well, I'm writing a book about a TV dog. But I thought, I can't begin to tell you how much bigger it feels to me than that, and how many bits of history were drawn into it, and how many ways it gave me an opportunity to look at history in a whole new way. I just want to tell you one more anecdote, and then I want to read a little more and save time for questions. So, because I could go on forever, but I shouldn't. Or maybe I will. What do you think? Go on forever? One of the most amazing sort of sidetracks that I took on this book, and it's really one of my favorite parts of the book, besides the Dogs for Defense, which is one of the most insane things I've ever read about, which was this program to send your pet. And of course, as I'm reading it, I was looking at my own dog thinking, I can't begin to picture my dog on a battlefield. But people did it. Tens of thousands of Americans sent their pets to war. But another part of the book that I loved reporting was stumbling across this crazy story of these two women who basically introduced the idea of dog obedience to the United States. Now, everybody thinks that we've always known how to train dogs. I mean, doesn't seem like that big of a deal. But like so many things that I came across in the course of working on this book, it had a beginning. There was a point at which people first learned how to train dogs. It didn't just happen naturally. It happened because there was a point in time where dogs were no longer living outside on the ranch. They were living in the house, and they were misbehaving. And it was before Pavlov's theories on behavior had been published in English. And, you know, people just didn't know how to train their dogs. Well, these two women who I stumbled onto in my reporting had seen dog obedience being the first pioneering dog obedience being done in England. And they just thought, this is the future. We must train Americans how to train their dogs. And they converted a Airstream trailer to carry dogs, and they hitched it up to their car, and they did a 10,000-mile journey around the United States training people to train their dogs. And they were a sensation. They ended up performing in Yankee Stadium in front of 70,000 people, showing them that if you say sit and you push the dog down and you give them a treat, they'll sit. And it's funny because you think, were people that stupid? They couldn't figure it out? But again, this was something where, you know, there was a point at which certain things were new to discover. And the story of their journey
struck me as, you know, I love learning history through a window that I never knew existed before, and that was certainly one. They were traveling around the country. It was sort of at the end of the Depression. It was unheard of for two women to travel unaccompanied by men, not to mention with a bunch of dogs, and stopping at towns along the way to demonstrate how to make your dog sit and how to have it stop barking and stay, and, you know, things that now seem absurdly simple to us. It's a journey that I had never heard of and hardly could believe had existed. But that's what the book was like for me. It was just discovery after discovery of sort of almost miraculous moments that were all threaded through the story of Rin Tin Tin in all of his various incarnations, from Rin Tin Tin the First, who was born in 1918 and died in 1932, and all the subsequent Rin Tin Tins since then. I want to read one last section from the book, because I think we're probably getting close to time for questions. And I spent a lot of time down in Texas, where the Rin Tin Tin dogs who exist, who are being bred today, mainly live down in Texas. So this is a section from one of those trips to visit Daphne Hereford, who breeds the dogs. And I guess I like reading this section because it sort of brings me back once again to the probably where this whole book began to begin with, which was falling in love with this very particular iconic dog and having grown up dreaming of him. At the end of that hot, hot day at Daphne's house in Texas, I got ready to drive to the Houston airport for my flight back to Boston, where I was living at the time. I noticed that there was one puppy, a tiny, dark, wide-eyed female, still sitting on Daphne's lawn, her head resting on her paws. She had been sold to a family in Boston and was going to be shipped to them the next day. As I said goodbye, Daphne realized I was heading to Boston myself, and she asked if I could take the puppy with me as hand luggage, saving her the shipping fee. I was happy to do it. She was an adorable puppy, a bit shy and worried looking, with a wrinkly brow and a whip of a tail and feet like little black paddles. She sat in a heap on my back seat during the drive from Crockett to Houston, glancing out the window and then quickly looking away. I realized that she probably had never been in a car before. After 30 miles or so, she started to look a little peaked, and when I stopped to let her amble around on a patch of grass behind a fast food joint, she promptly threw up and then fell asleep. On the flight home, she sat at my feet, and when she wasn't napping, she gave me a melting look that had the terrible effect of making me hope the people who had bought her had changed their minds and that the puppy would end up staying with me. Just like that, the German Shepherd I had dreamed of as a kid, the dog I had wanted from the beginning of time, would finally, at last, belong to me. But when we landed and I carried her out to the baggage claim, the whole family was there, as of course I knew they would be, and they squealed and shrieked with excitement when they spotted me, when they spotted the puppy, that is. And they raced up and pried her out of my arms. And within a moment, they were gone, and she was gone, and I was left without her, standing by the baggage carousel. I had no right to cry about it, but I couldn't help it. For that moment, at least, after a lifetime of imagining it, that shy, worried, tender, heroic, brave, loyal, gallant puppy had been mine. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. So I'd love to take questions, and I think we have a nice chunk of time, so make them good. And I'll take the second question, because nobody likes to ask a first question. So who would like to ask the second question? Please. Yes, go ahead. I'm going to repeat the questions for the podcast, if you don't mind. So the question is, what's the reporting process on something huge like that? To begin with, I started with the concrete, the things I thought, look, most of the people who I'm going to be writing about are not alive. So what I want to begin with is any here and now that I can find. So I began by going down to Texas and just starting where I could begin learning. And I really see reporting as just an education. I want to learn this subject, and I'm going to treat it the way I would anything where I want to do a crash course in Rin Tin Tin. So you begin first by going to the lecture, essentially. I thought, I'm going to first meet with people who know a lot. I met with Daphne. I started looking online. I found a couple people who are Rin Tin Tin collectors, or, you know, they clearly were, it was a hobby, and I began meeting with all of them. Then I thought, I've got to now start looking for archival material. And this was new for me. So I didn't really even know how you find archival material, but I started thinking, well, there is a library of film and television. I know that. They're going to have stuff. The Warner Brothers archives, that's got to exist. I got lucky. I quickly discovered that Lee Duncan's papers existed. Someone said to me the other day, how did you find them? And I cannot remember now how it happened. I mean, I just don't remember. It may have been that I Googled Lee Duncan and it came up, because a lot of libraries actually have on their website what their collections are, and I'm guessing that's what it was. And I just thought, I've just got to educate myself and go every different direction. And I begin without a clue of how I'm going to organize the book, how I'm going to write the book. I think that's I think it's a bad thing to have a roadmap, because if you can plot out your path before you've begun to learn, there's something wrong. It should be a surprise. And I feel like the way I like to write is as if I'm saying to people, I just learned an amazing story, and I'm going to take you almost through the learning process with me. I did try to do the reporting more or less chronologically for no reason other than just keeping myself a little bit organized, because I suddenly realized it was such a huge span of time. So I thought, all right, I'm going to begin with Lee Duncan's papers. Well, then I had to go back even further than that. Because the breed, the German Shepherd breed, was developed in the 1890s, so I backed up to think, okay, first I'm going to learn about the development of the breed. Then, you know, so it was each step of the way, I then had to sort of, I would learn about a piece of the story and then have to track off from that to learn the background of that section. And then I'd advance on and advance on. There was a point where I thought I'd finished all the reporting. It seemed to me that the book was really Lee Duncan's story and Daphne's story. It was the original Rin Tin Tin, and then it was Daphne and her continuing breeding of the dogs. And Burt Leonard, the producer of the television show in the 50s, struck me as not a footnote exactly, but not especially important. But I thought, I'm going to do my due diligence. I'm going to go, I'm giving you a very long answer. I hope you don't mind. I thought, I'm going to just due diligence. There's, if an idea occurs to me, I cannot not report it. As much as I pretend to not, I try to push it out of my mind and think, I don't want to go to do that reporting, but if I've thought of it, I can't. I have trouble not doing it. So I should go try to talk to his daughter. So I went to California. I met with his daughter. And, you know, I had a sort of perfunctory interview with her. And towards the end, I said, oh, well, listen, thanks. Great talking to you. Closed my notebook. Always the sign that you're about to start hearing the interesting stuff. Closed the notebook. Put on my coat. In fact, there should be something where you do it like a half an hour before you really want to leave, because that's when people start talking. And she said to me, you know, now that I think about it, I think my dad had a storage unit. And I thought, I don't know if I really want to know this, because I was kind of thinking I was done with my reporting. And I smiled. I said, really? And she said, yeah, wait a minute. And I thought, oh, God, should I run? Should I stay? And she went upstairs, and I sat there, and I thought, she's probably wrong, or she won't have the key or whatever. And she came down. She's swinging this key. And she said, you know, I don't know what's in there. Help yourself. So I drove over to the storage unit, and, you know, I was really torn between wanting there to be nothing there because I was so ready to write, and, of course, being wildly curious. I opened, and I wrote about this in the book and described it, because it was really one of those moments where I open the storage unit, and it's simply stacked to the ceiling with boxes, most of which were marked Rin Tin Tin. 2 years later. Yeah, but I do feel like the way I report is just throw my net as wide as I can, learn on the fly, and don't write a word. Don't outline, don't put pen to paper till I'm at a point where I feel like I could tell you the book out loud, literally. And that then all I'm doing really, and I'm exaggerating this a little, but that all I'm doing then is sitting down and in an orderly way, putting it on paper. Some people do drafts, or they'll write sections while they're working because they know they're going to include this particular section. It doesn't work for me at all. I have to begin at the beginning as if I'm saying to you, I just learned this wonderful story. You know, German Shepherds, well, first of all, you know, it's crazy, but they were actually developed in the 1890s, you know, that I'm telling you the story and organizing it, of course. And if I were a good outliner, it would probably make my life much easier, but I'm not. So to be absolutely sort of nuts and bolts technical, I don't use a tape recorder. I do, you know, notebooks when I'm interviewing people. When I was doing the archives, I had a laptop with me and typed up notes. Then I print all of that out. Then I transfer it all to note cards. And I had, I had about 800 index cards that were, you know, where I was breaking out ideas into manageable pieces. Then I spread them all out in a very large space, so I could begin looking and seeing if it was going to begin resolving into thematic threads. In this case, then I was also organizing them sort of chronologically. And then I started writing. And those were my, you know, my breadcrumbs as I was working. You know, there are all sorts of writing programs, Scrivener and blah, 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 blah. And I just felt that I needed I needed to see more at once than you can see on a computer screen to organize. The book had to hold together as a whole. And I just felt that there's a limit to a computer in that way. You don't ever see as much at once as you do if you have 800 index cards spread out. I mean, it was madness, really, you know. And then I'd start thinking, wait, where's that one about, you know, and I'd have to go through all the cards, and, it, you know, there was no control F to find it. But It was, and occasionally I did go back to the computer, print out again what I thought was on the card because I couldn't find the card, and it was insane. But that's the way I did The Orchid Thief too. And I urge people, how many of you are writers? Just so I know how tedious it is to be detailed. You know, find the way that works for you. Don't necessarily follow someone else's advice. But John McPhee uses index cards, and it struck me as a really good amount to see at once, that you could have a mental image of what was on an index card, and they could be organized. So that was the inspiration for using that system, and although calling it a system is rather grand, I think. So I hope that it's helpful. Yes, sir.
What kind of condition are the silent films and the television series at this point? And are there plans for a renaissance of Ingentin?
The question is, what is the condition of the films and TV, the original ones, and the future? The silent films are, there's one, Clash of the Wolves, that has been restored and is beautiful. It looks great. It was restored by the National Film Preservation Foundation, and it's available in a collection they have called Treasures from the Archives, which is really wonderful. I think it's every 5 years Congress has awarded them money to restore some film that is considered American heritage. And Clash of the Wolves is on that original set, which is a great set anyway, but Clash of the Wolves looks great. This is the copy that came from South Africa, and the original one is at Library of Congress. And as far as we know, it's the only one that exists. The other silent films are in decent quality. I mean, they're in good enough shape, and you can buy most of those. There's one website called Grapevine Video that specializes in silent film, and that's where I got mine. And they're in pretty good condition. I mean, they're viewable. Interestingly, one of Rin Tin Tin's first talkies, which was, I don't know if anybody recognized the little boy who has Rin Tin Tin in my video, Rin Tin Tin's head in his lap, was Robert Blake, who was a child actor, and one of his first big roles was in this film, Return of Rin Tin Tin. And anyway, that is in horrible shape. You know, and that is a more recent film, but it's awful. And I've never been able to find a copy. I think it's just whatever is the one that's available that people are copying is just in terrible condition. The TV show, I got a complete set of all 5 seasons, which is probably a gray market item because technically they've never been released on DVD, and they're in very good shape, although it's hilarious because the commercials are included, and which I happen to love. I mean, it really is like a complete time machine. The reason that I think they've not been released the way a lot of old shows have been released in nice cleaned up copies is that the ownership of the television series got very chopped up. Burt Leonard, the producer, fell very deeply into debt in his later years and gave away ownership of some of the episodes and owed Sony a bunch of money for some of it. So they've been in dispute, and nobody has officially said, okay, let's make a DVD set. But I did get it, and you know, they're actually really fun to watch. The stories, what I find interesting is the stories are kind of adult. They're not I mean, of course there's a little boy, but the story really is more adult than that. In fact, I wrote about the very last episode of the show, which is, I don't know what a kid would think of it. It's about a man who believes he's a failure, so he abandons his family because he's humiliated that he can't make a better living. And then the banker in town is going to take over their house. Sounds a little familiar, right? They're going to foreclose on their house, and the banker's going to take it over, and the kids are going to be sent to an orphanage. And the man then is found and brought back home, and he says he's still a failure. And it's really downbeat. And as I was watching it, I thought, what would a little kid make of this? It's so, you know, and Burt Leonard, who I admired tremendously and who became a really fascinating character to me, as much as his own folly and unfortunately led him to a pretty bad end. But he wanted the stories to be serious and to be moral stories that, and they didn't cater to children. Even though we think of it as the ultimate kids TV show, a lot of the themes of the shows were pretty serious. And I would say for a kid to see a show where a father believes he's a failure, so he abandons the family, is a kind of a downer. anyway, they're very, very interesting to watch. As for future iterations, I'm pretty sure that we'll have a documentary from the book, which I'm excited about. And I'm also pretty sure that there will be a movie made from it, which is going to be very interesting and also an incredible irony. Since, have any of you read the book yet? You'll see the irony of if there is a movie made of the book, because there's a theme running through the whole book of how Lee Duncan desperately wanted the story of his life made into a movie. Not for his own vanity, but because he felt that he'd experienced something really extraordinary, that he was this deeply lonely boy who really could only relate to animals. And in the middle of World War I, with death all around, he finds newborn puppies. And to him, it was something he never got over in the nicest sense. To him, it was as if someone had simply dropped light into his life. And he loved the dogs, perhaps to the exclusion of his family, but to him, the miracle of that change in his life was a story he wanted told. So it would be a kind of marvelous irony if that ends up happening. And it would be a bring this full circle in a way that would be kind of amazing. And Meryl Streep will not play Rin Tin Tin. Despite rumors. Should I take one more question? Okay. Yes, sir. The Lassie question. You know, it's so funny because I loved Lassie when I was a kid. Love Lassie. And I have no beef with Lassie. I love Lassie. May I repeat, I love Lassie. There, as a writer, the Lassie story is very limited. Lassie was a children's book written in the 40s that became a movie and then became a TV show. And the dogs in the movie and the TV shows were dogs trained by Hollywood trainers. And, you know, it is what it is. There's no deeper story. To me, the deep story of Rin Tin Tin was the fact that it began in an entirely different way with a real dog who belonged to a guy who said, I want my dog to be in movies. So it began with this real relationship between Lee and the dog that turned into a Hollywood story. But there's another reason that I think this is a better subject, and that is German Shepherds are a fascinating breed that have this complex history because of their development in the late 1890s, because of their presence in the military beginning in World War I, because of the Nazi obsession with them, because of their presence in the U.S. Army. You know, they've had this very complicated history, and German Shepherds totally dominated film. In the 1920s, there were 80 German Shepherds starring in movies. We didn't see a collie on film till the first Lassie movie. So, there has been this phenomenal history of German Shepherds in popular culture. And then, as I wrote in the book, their reputation really changed in the 1960s, where they were seen in association with police oppression and attacking civil rights marchers. And suddenly the German Shepherd, whose nobility had been so inspiring, became, associated with something really negative. And so there's been a very, very interesting history of the breed, which collies, as beautiful and wonderful as they are, they haven't had that kind of history that's so fascinating. It would be hard to spin this kind of book out of it. I do feel, though, that there's a kind of defensiveness among the Lassie people that I feel upset about. So, I mean, there may be a pamphlet that I'll issue on Lassie. I will say one more thing, and then I'll stop, which is it cracks me up that Lassie and Rin Tin Tin were on television beginning in 1954. People still haven't gotten over the rivalry. How many years ago was that? I can't do the math. It's amazing. Even now, I think, I can't believe it's still going on. I mean, it was a huge rivalry in the 50s. They were, of course, of competitors. But it was more than that. It was like Rolling Stones versus Beatles. Are you a Lassie person? Are you a Rin Tin Tin person? And even now, to think 50 years ago, this is where it began, and people still feel like, well, so what's the problem with Lassie? Anyway, I want to thank you all. I can't imagine a nicer evening to sort of set off my break before I get back on the road again, and a more wonderful place than at Tattered Cover. And I just want to thank you all so very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.